Thank you all for coming to this very popular panel on queer workers and labor museums and queer memory, or at least two of the papers will talk about that. My name is Tone Hellesund. I'm a professor of cultural studies in Bergen, Norway, and heavily affiliated with the Norwegian Queer Archive. And I will chair the panel and make sure that we are on time, and I'm very happy to be able to hear these three very exciting papers. We have Lena Ahonen from Finland, Geraldine Sela from Australia, and Rebecca Hale from the UK, and they will talk about their projects. And the next one out is Geraldine Sela, and she's a PhD candidate at Monash University in Melbourne, and for her doctoral thesis, for her research, she is interviewing nurses from across Australia who worked during the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 1980s, and the 1990s. Her honours thesis on a similar topic was awarded Australian Lesbian and Gay Archive Thesis Prize. So please, Geraldine, tell us all about HIV in the 1980s and 1990s.
Thanks so much. Thanks. It's wonderful to have so many people in the room. So, thank you all for coming. My research looks at the role of Australian nurses or nurses working in Australia in the 80s and 90s. And it's an oral history thesis, so I'm interviewing nurses in each state and territory in Australia, which is quite a lot of states and territories in Australia. It's a very geographically diverse country. So, it's been very interesting for that reason. So I'll just give you a really quick overview of HIV in Australia. In some ways the story is similar to elsewhere, in some ways it's different. So the first case of what was then called AIDS was diagnosed in Sydney in 1982, which is a little later than elsewhere in the world. And it was only just a year or 6 months even before the HIV virus was actually discovered. And as elsewhere in the world, it was in 1996 that we got the first effective treatment for HIV, highly active antiretroviral therapy. And in those 14 years of crisis in Australia, between 6,000 and 7,000 people died of AIDS. And the vast majority of them were gay men. So we didn't have the situation that happened elsewhere in the world where the virus really spread into other sections of the community. It was largely contained to gay men. And in those 14 years before the highly active antiretroviral therapy, the work that nurses did was particularly important. And this is why I'm interested in nursing stories. Because medicine could do very little for people with AIDS, but nurses could provide emotional care, comfort and support. And there are many stories that I could tell of the kind of work that nurses did. I often think of one story, which is a nurse in Perth in Western Australia who wheeled a young man's bed out onto his balcony so he could see his last sunrise and sat with him in bed all night and held him. And she was the same age as him, about 25. Many of the nurses learnt massage and different kinds of physical therapy so that they could ease people's aches and pains, but also just to touch people because people weren't being touched. So these kind of, very intimate and personal modes of care were extremely important, and their stories are very moving. And there are, I could talk for 45 minutes, just with examples of the kind of care that nurses did. But what I want to talk about today is something that is a little bit more difficult and a little bit more complicated, because though the vast majority of nurses were working in clinics and wards and providing this kind of care, doing medical testing and pre-test counselling and providing education, a small minority of nurses played a very different role. And these nurses were at the coalface of enforcing an aspect of Australia's public health response to HIV that has gone largely undiscussed, or in fact entirely undiscussed, in the literature. And that's the incarceration of HIV-positive people who were deemed recalcitrant or a risk to the broader community. And these nurses acted essentially as jailers monitoring and controlling the movements of their charges. And what makes this particularly interesting and I think relevant to people outside Australia is that the response of the Australian government is generally considered to have been the best in the world at the time. In 1983, a Labor government was elected in Australia, and a man who was married, but let's just say had close links to the gay community, Neil Blewett, was the Federal Minister of Health. So unlike in the UK and in the US, where the AIDS crisis was overseen by conservative governments, Reagan and Thatcher, who drew battle lines around the normality of heterosexuality and the sanctity of the family, the federal and most state governments in Australia developed really close ties with the gay community. There were state-based community groups that were gay-run, called AIDS councils, that received federal and often state funding. And they created detailed and sexually explicit safe sex information that, looking back on it now, it's quite astounding. I mean, in some ways, I wish we had information like that now. Like, it was very good. And for this reason, the response to the virus is framed very much in terms of collaboration in how people understand it historically. So Australian queer historian Shirlene Robertson calls it the Australian model, and this is quite a common term used, and describes the model as characterised by close collaboration between doctors, scientists, government officials and affected communities. Likewise, Paul Sendzook, who's written perhaps the most comprehensive history of Australia's response to HIV and AIDS, argues that the Australian model emphasised community cooperation, harm minimisation and education, rather than the identification of infected individuals and the curtailment of their activities. And he considers this approach to be one of the most innovative and successful in the world. But the testimony of nurses suggests that this was true in some cases. Certainly it was often true in the kind of inner city neighbourhoods of Sydney and Melbourne. But that once we look outside those areas, and once you start looking at people who existed on the margins of society, notably Indigenous people, poor people and sex workers, that there was a very different response to HIV and AIDS happening kind of behind the curtains. So I'm going to talk to you now about two interviews that I conducted recently with two different nurses, and I think they demonstrate how nursing stories and oral history can really challenge queer histories and in this case, the history of HIV/AIDS in Australia. Now, my first interview is with this woman, Lizzie Griggs, and she worked in Sydney on the Albion Street bus, which was a mobile unit that moved around like Oxford Street, which is like the gay centre of Sydney, King's Cross, which is where a lot of sex workers work and worked then as well. And they handed out, you know, free condoms, free lube, they did testing, they did needle exchange. It's very progressive policy. I'm just going to play the clip. I didn't embed it because embedding never works, so sorry. okay.
You did what you needed to do. So we used to say to the guys, listen, you're not supposed to, but if you do continue working, you absolutely have to use condoms. All the time. Better still, don't do anal sex, just stick to oral and other sorts of stuff. So it was that minimisation approach again. Because the reality was they were going to be working. So we're not going to dob them in, you know. And, I mean, the whole thing with poor Charlene was because, you know, she had so many different issues, but she was sucked into doing that stupid interview with 60 Minutes. I think they paid her. And that was the end of her life, honestly. She was so managed right up until the day she died, that poor girl.
She was put in Callan Park, wasn't she?
For a while, yeah. And then she was like 24/7 supervised and chemically... managed for her condition that she had, not HIV, but mental health issues and stuff like that. But she was like really, really chemically managed so that she couldn't really do anything. Yeah, it's terrible.
Okay, so the case that she's talking about here is Charlene, who was... This is the most famous case of these recalcitrant cases. She was an HIV-positive sex worker. She basically got tricked into doing an interview on a famous or infamous current affairs program on Australian television where she admitted that she was still working. And in response, the government incarcerated her until she died, which was not that long ago, 2008. And they basically chemically restrained her. Now, Charlene's case is actually quite a famous one because of the public furor that erupted around her, and it has been discussed in the literature. There's been a podcast made by the National Broadcaster. It's kind of fairly well known. But the interesting thing about it is it's always discussed as an aberration, so a kind of an exceptional case in which public hysteria and moral panic overrule the otherwise dominant principles of pragmatism and harm minimisation that was supposedly central to the Australian model. And I think you can kind of see that in Lizzie's interview. Like, she starts off by talking about the work of the Albion Street bus, which was incredible. The advice she was giving to people was pragmatic, it was frank, you know, and it didn't moralise or demonise people. But the story of Charlene is a very sharp contrast. And the interesting thing was that once I heard this story, I then heard it over and over again, suggesting that this was very much not an aberration or an exceptional case, but was happening quite a lot, and particularly in Western Australia. So I conducted an interview just after this one with Alan Phillips, who was a nurse in Western Australia, and he now works for the public service, but he was originally employed by the AIDS Bureau as a trained nurse. So the AIDS Bureau was like a semi sort of private little department in the West Australian government. And his job was to use a 1911 Health Act that was developed for cholera to manage people with HIV and AIDS that they deemed to be recalcitrant and a risk to the community. And in this next section, Alan explains what that was like and what he did.
The only legislation we had was the old 1911 Health Act. So, in fact, we had to try and manage them under that. And that act said that, you know, if others are put at risk with infectious diseases, we'll just retain them. We'll just stop them doing things. And it was sort of like, okay. And they had no right of appeal. You couldn't actually appeal to anybody because... The executive director of public health actually had the right to restrict their movement. So in this one particular case, we then really had a 24/7 management of this individual. So in fact, I had a whole team of people that would live with this person in this accommodation and look after them and do everything for them. So, you know, we'd take them to appointments. We'd actually take them to entertainment. And our job was really just to be with them every day and actually try and manage that, which is quite a challenge, but in a way that you needed to do it in a sort of humanistic way and making sure that we didn't restrict too much. But they were restricting what they did. They couldn't actually leave our individuals. They couldn't go off anywhere in terms of on their own because of the belief that they were going to be putting others at risk.
What did they think of that?
Oh, they hated it. Well,
so he managed three men this way. One of them was a sex worker, another an injecting drug user, and the third an Indigenous gay man. And it was very hard to figure out from him how it was decided that these people were of a risk to the community, though the fact that the Act did not require any threshold of proof did mean that it was a sort of arbitrary decision based on a general suspicion that this person was engaged in risky behaviour. And perhaps the most revealing case, I think, was that of Patrick, who is the Aboriginal gay man. And the rationale for Patrick's detention was what Alan called his flamboyant lifestyle, a lifestyle that the health department deemed to be inherently risky to the community. And he talks about that in this next clip.
Yeah. And then for the Indigenous guy, it was he just lived a flamboyant lifestyle. That, you know, for him, you know, intoxication and getting into, you know, as a party boy. So he'd be out partying all the time, and, you know, he used to sort of say to him, no, you can't actually do that, mate. and I remember one of his family had died, and so we had to go to the rural area to actually take him to the funeral, and that was quite a challenge because he didn't want us hanging around. You know, he was going to the family stuff, and so we were going, well, okay, we'll go and we'll just stand back and sort of do that, and, you know, we'd go somewhere else and pick up family and bring them back and do that sort of stuff, and so, you know, it became sort of, you know, like I said, we looked up as best we could. And like,
now, if a flamboyant lifestyle was criterion enough for detention, then certainly this could have applied to vast number of men in Perth at the time. But it didn't, but it did apply to Patrick. And why was this? So like many HIV-positive people, Patrick was sexually active. He wore drag, he partied, and like many young gay people, particularly at the time, he was quite itinerant. He slept rough, he couch surfed. And Alan suggested to me that there was a suspicion that he was not always disclosing his status to sexual partners. And if that was true, then it's certainly irresponsible, but it was not exactly uncommon, and there was certainly no suggestion that he was purposefully infecting people or putting others at risk. So why was he singled out for this management? And I think in this case, one of the central factors was his indigeneity. Because whilst efforts were being made at the time to extend the reach of AIDS councils, they did primarily cater to a particular demographic of urban, largely white, community-attached gay men. And Patrick, an Indigenous man from rural Western Australia, may have struggled to access or not even known about the services available through the AIDS Council and associated gay networks. If he had accessed these services and networks, I doubt that his flamboyancy would have raised an eyebrow. But instead, he was coming into contact with mainstream health services where his lifestyle was a cause for comment and concern. And I think as well his treatment by the health system was inflected with particular dynamics to the context of Australia as a colonial state and Patrick as a colonised subject within it. Chelsea Bond and Meg Parsons, who are two Indigenous academics, point out that public health responses in Australia have routinely pathologised Indigeneity. Simply being Indigenous is routinely identified as a risk factor in health and medical discourse. As Bond argues in her analysis of health promotion campaigns targeted at Indigenous communities, they symbolise a deeper fundamental message about colonial relationships of power and control and the presumed capabilities, or rather deficiencies, of Indigenous people. And this made me think of how Fanon reflects in Dying Colonialism about how medicine can become a theatre in which the complex and often violent relations between colonial states and subjects play out. He notes medical science and concern for one's health have always been proposed or imposed by the occupying power. In the colonial situation, going to see the doctor, the administrator, the constable, or the mayor are identical moves. In other words, medicine is closely interwoven with regimes of colonial control. And I think in this retelling that in Alan's story here, in his retelling of his interactions with Patrick, there's one very clear example of this. When he recalls himself and a number of other nurses accompanying Patrick back to his community, where Patrick is engaging in ceremony business with his family. So not only are Patrick's daily movements and decisions monitored and controlled, his cultural and his spiritual life become subject to this management regime. And interestingly, it seems that Alan's management occurred within a wider policy context in which HIV was being used to incarcerate young Aboriginal men. In 1987, Phil Carswell travelled to Western Australia. Now, Phil is a really long-time gay advocate in Australia. He was the founding member of the AIDS Council in Victoria and was on the National Advisory Committee on AIDS, which was a huge, you know, a very significant body. So he travelled to Western Australia to oversee how the national strategy was being implemented there. And what he found was that, in his own words, the health department was using testing and incarceration to deal with a whole cohort of young Aboriginal boys. According to Phil, he used that term, they were young, they were like 13, 14. According to Phil, they used HIV and the Health Act to give themselves the power to detain these young people who were deemed troublemakers. Phil and another colleague wrote a report about this to the National Committee, but the report was never published because it was feared that this would undermine the national strategy. So So I think both Alan and Lizzie's testimony trouble the dominant historical narrative of the Australian model. And this isn't to say that there wasn't world-leading practice in many healthcare services in Australia, nor that there wasn't close collaboration between sections of government, healthcare workers and the gay community. Certainly this did occur, and things like Lizzie's testimony are a testament to that kind of pragmatic healthcare. But what these nurses do reveal is that the story is a little more complicated, and for those at the margins of society who are not community connected, who are not living in the gay neighbourhoods of inner cities, Melbourne and Sydney, the experience of Australia's response to HIV was not necessarily of harm minimisation and pragmatism. It was very punitive. And I think in this there's a broader methodological point that's worth making, which is that without this oral testimony, these histories would be extremely difficult to find and to understand. So I've gone through the written archive. There's plenty of government documents about HIV. A lot of it's been kept. There's heaps in newspapers, in newsletters, and in all of this, there are oblique references to case management and recalcitrant cases. There are some bureaucratic checklists and procedures outlining how these might be managed. But aside from Charlene's case, there's no record of what this management actually entailed, of who was managed, of how many people were managed, and what this meant for their lives. And certainly, I don't think oral history can give us that full picture either, but it can give us important snapshots into the lived experience of these aspects of public health policy, and those aspects of public health policy that the government would rather we didn't remember. For example, the report that was never published and likely destroyed. So we could never, from the written archive, understand the particular racial dynamics of how this policy played out in Western Australia, but we can begin to understand that from oral testimony. It only became apparent to me when I started talking to people about it. And to me, this is a really potent reminder of the importance of recording and archiving oral sources. As Paul Thompson so eloquently puts it, oral testimony introduces new evidence from the underside. This opens up new lines of inquiry, and what we can write about and what is knowable is enlarged and enriched.
Thank you so much, Geraldine, for this very interesting paper. And the next one and last one out is Rebecca Hale, who has been working on the learning teams of the Norfolk Museum Service since 2016. She is particularly interested in dissenting or taboo subjects in the museum. And she also works as an educational freelancer and live interpreter, most recently working on creating education material in Suffolk to engage young people with politics. So please, Rebecca.
Thank you. Okay, so welcome to my paper on telling lower class LGBTQ plus stories. I started exploring LGBTQ plus stories about a year ago as part of my AMA qualification through the UK's Museums Association. My explorations found that many museums and institutions in the UK have queered their collections in the past few years and exploring LGBTQ plus connections and stories within their own museums. This includes, for example, the V&A, the National Trust, Cambridge Museums, and of course we learn obviously of Oxford University Museums as well. They've developed public tours or trails highlighting these stories, and these inspired me to begin this process in the museums I work within, as nothing had been done so far to tell these stories. However, many of the examples those museums I just mentioned have included are those from the upper classes and are widely recognised names. For instance, they refer to people like Michelangelo, Oscar Wilde, Virginia Woolf, Robert Walpole, a local upper-class landowner, and Lord Nelson. When researching this area to see how this could be applied to the museums I work within, one thing struck me. Where are the examples of ordinary and lower-class LGBTQ plus people in the past that could represent the communities that the museums I work within serve today? So this paper and this presentation will look at the process that I have begun to seek an answer to investigate in those lower class stories, the challenges I've faced and how I have and will continue to overcome them. So just to give you a little bit of context about the museum, the main museum I work with in, which is Gresson Hall Farm and Workhouse, which is where I am a learning officer. Yes, so very cute this year. So Gresson Hall is part of a council-wide museum service across the county of Norfolk in the UK. Norfolk is a predominantly rural county, only has one city within it, which is Norwich. A third of all children living in Norfolk are living in poverty. Gresson Hall is a museum that consists of a farm of approximately 50 acres. It includes animals, as you can see there, and heritage machinery. The workhouse was opened in 1834. Workhouses were part of a state system in the UK that housed paupers, offering them food, bed, clothing, and shelter in return for work. The workhouse system split up families, had strict rules, and provided them with the utmost basic provisions as a deterrent from coming in. Gresson Hall Workhouse closed in the 1940s and became an old people's home, and then a museum for rural life in the workhouse in the 1970s. So our museum represents some of the most vulnerable people in society. And it kept detailed records so we today can see who entered, when they left, and if anything happened during their stay. So I wanted to investigate our LGBTQ plus stories and connections within this setting. Also, my research had highlighted the wider context of the importance in this work, particularly in the UK at the moment. For example, as you can see here, it's been reported that hate crime against LGBTQ plus people in the UK rose by 147% in the 3 months following the Brexit vote and has continued to rise since then. In Norfolk itself, it's been questioned why there are so few gay people living there, suggesting that the rural nature of the county seems far less accepting than other urban centres such as London, Brighton and Manchester. Also, reports also show that LGBTQ plus people comprise up to 24% of the homeless population in the UK, and homelessness continues to be a key problem in Norwich and Norfolk. Today, LGBTQ plus people and those in Norfolk are clearly vulnerable, and if our museum was meant to help those most vulnerable in the past, then I wanted it to do the same today. So I then went about this investigation. I asked our curator and team of research volunteers to see if they knew of or could look out for anything LGBTQ plus related in our records or object lists. Understanding the language of the past was essential for this, as whilst LGBTQ plus is nothing new, the language has changed and altered over time, especially during the period when sodomy and homosexuality was a crime in the UK. I also used examples from other museums to see if any of these connections could also be found at the workhouse and farm. Our curator was hugely supportive, and by searching for recognised LGBTQ plus connections, we had many hits initially. For instance, we have a copy of the book The Little Mermaid in our schoolhouse used in the workhouse system. The Little Mermaid is originally written by Hans Christian Andersen, and many believe that the story reflects his own unrequited love for the Duke Edvard Colin. And The Little Mermaid can also symbolise the transgender process, and the UK charity Mermaids supports young people who identify as trans and their families. So our curator has also begun to update our records to include these stories as part of the collection records, showing clear legacy to this work and enabling future searches for them. Now, I wanted then to think about this lower class and local lens. So using our work on identifying LGBTQ plus stories, we invited a youth group in our museum service to come to do a queer tour at Gresson Hall as part of their arts award. They identified the stories they would like to tell using our list and initial research. And for instance, In our Land Girl Gallery, we tell the story of how land girls helped to produce more food on our farms for the First and Second World War in Norfolk. They use this gallery to tell the story of, here we are, Vita Sackville West. So Sackville West was part of the Bloomsbury set and wrote the book The Women's Land Army in 1944 to highlight the important work of the women who worked on farms during wartime. And she provides detailed depictions of their daily lives. Sackville West was also bisexual and had a same-sex relationship with Virginia Woolf. So whilst this story was a very valid story to tell, again, it didn't really relate to Norfolk, and especially not the lower classes. It was interesting to me that this youth group looked at our gallery of local stories, and to link it to LGBTQ+, they immediately linked it to someone from the upper classes and from Kent near London. So it led me to think, was being openly LGBTQ+ part of the privilege of class in the past in the UK? And had work in UK museums established this as a truth? Would people in Norfolk see LGBTQ+ as something that didn't and doesn't happen there and to people like them? Therefore, I tried to take these stories and look at them with a lower class and local lens. So, for instance, we have the story of Olive Crosswell, who was a land girl in Norfolk during the First World War. And she spoke about how men threw stones at her legs when she wore breeches, as you can see here in that third picture, instead of a skirt to work in. The men on the farms were angry and disgusted at her for essentially challenging gender stereotypes. When I brought this story to a prize society in a local secondary school, they were appalled that this had happened in the area they lived as little as 100 years ago. The local nature of the story had a great impact on them, and it made them consider how stones are still used today to bully and kill people because of their sexuality and gender. So, one thing then I wanted to research was our original documents in the workhouse to identify historical lower class LGBTQ+ stories. It was said to me at the top there that these stories just aren't here. My reply was they haven't been found yet. So I started by looking at our Guardian's reports, and the Guardians were in charge of running the workhouse. And during, obviously, the time of the workhouse, homosexuality was criminalised. So I also then thought about investigating our punishment book. In the punishment book, there are 9 counts of indecency between 1848 until 1940. However, the workhouse records did not have to detail what that indecency was. It could be indecency in terms of behaviour. It could be language, it could be rape, or it could be same-sex relations in men. Only one of those 9 cases resulted in an outside prison sentence, which was James King, who was charged with indecency with another inmate in 1931. However, there's no reporting of this case in the local newspapers, and the court case can only be accessed with special requests by the family, due to the date of the sentence. Therefore, whilst this one particular instance could relate to a gay sexual relationship in the workhouse, it is hard to ascertain that as a fact. This process in itself has been very telling. By investigating lower class LGBTQ+ stories, I have had to read about them through higher class voices in the past. It is the establishment's view and attitudes that are translated into these documents, not the voices of ordinary people. And by looking through court records and punishment books, it's also presenting a history that lower class LGBTQ+ people were persecuted in the past, rather than able to live any kind of freedom of sexuality or gender. It's also revealed the huge difficulty in discovering a fuller picture of the most vulnerable LGBTQ+ individuals in the past. There have been further references to these kind of attitudes within workhouse documents as well across the country. For instance, Mr. Cochrane was the chairman of the Poor Man's Guardian Society, and upon visiting workhouse wards in 1848, spoke about the disgust he felt at seeing men naked and sharing beds. From their inception, their workhouses separated genders in order to prevent pregnancies. And it was common practice in workhouses for people of the same sex to share beds to help save money and to maintain warmth and hygiene. However, Mr. Cochrane was particularly appalled at the, quote, disgusting nature of the male poor sleeping naked together, unquote. His direction of attitude towards the male poor is telling. In the UK, the law prohibited sodomy and gross indecency, which targeted same-sex relations between men rather than women with other women. And up until 1861, sodomy was also punishable by death, of which 48 men did die as a result of that charge in the UK, and no women did. Therefore, these suggestions and concerns about workhouses being homoerotic spaces shows an extension of the law into societal attitudes, and particularly in regard to the lower classes, or who were referred to as degenerate during this time, showing a further class divide on LGBTQ+. At Gresson Hall Workhouse, we've also found references to these concerns in a report from the inspectors who described the evil practice of boys sleeping together at Gresson Hall Workhouse and the immediate request that that practice stop. I've also communicated with our workhouse network in the UK to see if their research has also warranted similar stories. Another workhouse has shared a story with me that was recorded as same-sex relations, but was actually a story about abuse between older and younger males. And the language used to identify LGBTQ+ in the lower classes is obscene and derogatory, and links that action with crimes we recognise today, such as bestiality and paedophilia. Whilst these examples show no acceptance of different genders or sexualities, this in itself is also a hugely important story to tell. The experience of the lower class in the past relate to the experience of the most vulnerable today. Poverty and sexuality can still be regarded with shame today. And in rural communities, such as where Gresson Hall is in Norfolk, there was and still is a feeling of isolation for marginalised groups. So I'm sharing Gresson Hall's LGBTQ+ stories in two ways. One is on a public tour in September. This has been organised as part of this year's Heritage Open Days programme, which is a national programme, which seeks to open up new stories or locations of heritage sites to the public for free for 10 days in September. The tour will then be free, and I hope that this then disables this common barrier to those in poverty to access museums and these stories. I've also instigated a social media programme that will reveal LGBTQ+ stories across 6 museums in Norfolk, and the project begins today, the 28th of June, to remember the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. It will highlight our stories as a way to show that LGBTQ+ people and stories are a key part of Norfolk's past, present and future. And to decide what stories to share and how to tell them, I've collaborated with the Pride Society at the local secondary school in Dereham, the local town. The school is called Nethered. In our first meeting with these teenagers, they told me how this had made them see Gresson Hall in a new way, which was much more positive than before. The assistant head teacher I'd organised this outreach programme alongside also said that this was important for them to be involved with due to LGBTQ+ protests at schools such as Birmingham, which you can see here. That school in particular wanted a public showing of support for LGBTQ+. And the social media project starts with a month of Gresson Hall stories and then goes to a different museum in the county each month the rest of the year. I have worked hard to get different museums to engage with this, organising training days and regular meetings to support them. And this social media project could engage democratically with a potentially wider audience than a tour would do. And by telling these stories in a really public way, my hope is that it reaches out to people who might otherwise not hear these stories. I then looked at ways to contemporary collect so that at Gresson Hall we do have fuller stories of local, rural and lower class LGBTQ+ stories. If we don't have them fully in the past, then let's make sure we have them from today. This is including speaking to the Pride Society and other scores, words groups such as UK Gay Farmers. I hope that this work will particularly continue into the future. Okay, so my work in this field has definitely seen change to researching and telling LGBTQ plus stories at Gresnell and other Norfolk museums. However, the process has not always been easy. And I worry that this work is not based in the institution at the moment, just with enthusiastic individuals such as myself. If I left, would this work continue to the same extent? I fear not. And I fear this because of the attitudes I have faced in proposing and doing this work. So these statements on the screen here and more have been said to me in the last year, and some have shocked, angered, upset and challenged me. If I take you through some of the examples and my responses to them, for instance, I've regularly been asked about the level of evidence I am using to prove LGBTQ plus connections. My response has often been, well, what level of evidence would you require to prove a straight relationship or connection? I'm not asking for anything more than that. For example, as I said earlier, about I'm not saying it didn't happen, just not here, or those stories aren't here. LGBTQ plus have always existed in every society, and whether there are records or not, it doesn't mean it didn't happen or it didn't happen here. For comments such as, well, these are just salacious rumours, or why do you have to make everything sordid? Well, it may have been recorded as salacious rumours, as also maybe that was the attitude of the time, and talking about LGBTQ plus is not sordid. This is a concern as well at the moment about outing people. So you can't out someone who wasn't out in their time. And this has been a concern with other institutions in the UK as well. And true, outing someone who hasn't outed themselves is wrong today in today's society. But why didn't they feel comfortable outing themselves then? Was it because the context of their time was hostile and they may have been imprisoned or killed? Those kind of stakes change the circumstance. And okay, I've had the response of, well, you can't say someone's gay when they weren't. In all cases, I'm not doing that. And why do you assume that they weren't? In lots of cases, there's been heteronormative assumptions of people in the past, which mean that this requirement of evidence is huge in order to tell gay and lesbian stories. Not to prove, actually, that person was gay, but to disprove then assumptions that that person was straight. Instead of assuming they were straight, maybe assume nothing about their sexuality. And then what would you think when you're presented with their story? To this question at the bottom right there, do our visitors want to hear about that sort of thing? I had a simple answer, yes. this question here, I wish I was brave enough to reply to the comment about upsetting fellow institutions and the local population with, well, would you rather have the support of the LGBTQ plus community or the homophobic one? But unfortunately, I wasn't. Facing these questions kept making me think of the kind of age-old President Kennedy quote, we don't do things because they are easy. But why was research and intent LGBTQ plus stories in 2019 so difficult? I will end with the question at the top, which I've been asked many times. What's the purpose of telling LGBTQ plus stories? Well, when I asked the Pride Society at their local Netherd High School, they said it was to raise awareness in a world that they still felt daily hate from. They said learning about these stories empowered them and made them think about their present and their future. Gresson Hall's history hadn't really been for them, now it was, particularly through highlighting real and local people. For me, it's all of that and more. I want to make sure our museums are truly welcoming and representative of the marginalised communities we say we serve. I believe in the transformative ability of museums, and in the words of Richard Sandel, who is a UK lead in this field, by telling LGBTQ plus stories, you will change somebody's life. You won't know it, but you will. If that's not a good enough purpose, then I don't know what is.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. And so many big and overarching themes that the three papers have touched upon, themes that I'm sure many of you relate to or are working on with a day-to-day basis, and papers relate to many other sessions I've also heard during this conference. So please, comments and questions to Lena, Geraldine, and Rebecca. Okay, I have some questions. I'm sure you can think a little bit. And just to I think some of the overarching themes here are both the collecting part. I mean, what kind of materials do we need to collect to be able to tell different kinds of stories that you've all touched upon? And then, of course, also these narratives, the relationship between different narratives, the overarching or the national narratives, and then the small local ones, and then the celebratory, the suffering, all the different kind of narratives that you kind of touched upon in your... And, of course, you're also welcome to comment on each other if you have questions. I was having one question for Lena about the relationship in your labor museum, which is also strongly connected with the with the labor unions in Finland. And can you say something about the processes in kind of transforming the labor museum from a more, well, that's my impression, from a more traditional labor museum to more postmodern labor museum? Has there been any issues with that at all?
Not really, not that I know of. I mean, I think it's, I mean, there are like, right-wing conservatives also in Finland that have risen, but we don't hear those voices. They don't come to us, and then I think in the like trade unions, and they know their responsibility, like, but they support our mission.
Thank you.
Thank you. This were really amazing presentations, really interesting. Rebecca, I would like to ask if you could tell a little bit more about how this collaboration with the queer youth group worked and what you actually did, because I found it quite interesting, but didn't really get what you actually did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's just up the road, the local secondary school, and they have a pride society, which is quite new. And they've done a lot of work of trying to raise awareness. So I contacted them, say, would they be interested in collaborating with this? And so it consisted of five different meetings in which I went to the school with them, and I introduced the kind of social media project to them and the work we've been doing at Gresnell, and asked if they would like to be involved, and they said yes. And then I took in some of the objects that I showed there. So, for example, I took in like the breeches to them and then told them that story. I took in, for example, the Little Mermaid book. I took in a Huntley and Palmer's biscuit tin we have, which is connected as well to the Wolfenden report in the UK, which was the report as well that was, offered to support the decriminalisation of homosexuality. But in it, they didn't want to use the word homosexuals and prostitutes, so they used Huntley and Palmer's instead. So this biscuit tin looked at that kind of language as well, and I took in lots of others, and then we narrowed this collection then down to 13 objects. And then in the kind of next meetings, I got them to write as well what we're putting on social media and what they wanted to say about these objects as well. So it's directly their voice that you're seeing on the posts as well, and so it's really making sure that they were having a real clear voice in this work as well. But also as well, they're going to come and help me to then develop the tour that we're running at Gresson Hall in September as well, so they would be supportive on both sides as well.
First in the corner here.
Yeah, thanks for the presentations. They were all excellent. Jolie, my questions for you. I have loads of questions here. I'll venture after the break.
Yeah.
But the question question tied to the prompt that you kind of gave a second ago has to do with the data collection itself. So had you already come to the theme of looking at specifically the sort of criminalization of HIV-positive folks before you started the oral histories? And they asked because if you already had known that as your tool, how did you get these nurses to get to that topic without sort of giving away what you were interested in or shaping how they would talk about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I didn't know about it. I had no idea. And in fact, pretty much no one that I've spoken to has any idea, apart from people who are intimately involved, like through the AIDS councils and stuff. So it was I pretty much walked into this interview with Alan. He'd sent me a very vague outline of, like, I was involved with the AIDS Bureau, blah, blah, blah. I walked in and this story came out and I basically had to hide my shock for an hour and a half, which is pretty... And then once I heard that story from him, then other nurses that I spoke to, I would often ask them at the end of the interview, did you know about, you know, do you have any experience with this, have you heard of this happening, blah blah blah, and then more and more stories will come out.
You're prompting then, so really even the way nurses have they memorialized their own experiences, it's not part of their own narratives.
No. Yeah. And it was part of Alan's because that was the only thing he did. But the others, it's a bit of a side, you know, that was going on, but you know. One guy I spoke to now, and this is, I didn't get to touch on it in the presentation, but it's still happening, this kind of this management of recalcitrant cases. It's not incarceration, but people are still put under public health orders. And one of the nurses I spoke to now is in that position doing that, but he was very critical of it, unlike Alan, who wasn't.
First, I think I saw a hand there.
Just a quick follow-up to Rebecca. Could you just say how large that pride group is and the age range?
Yes, so the age range is from 11 to 16. And in different weeks, there's about 12 of them. But in different weeks, that is varied, you know, who wants to come because it's voluntary. But so quite a good
age.
It's
like a school club.
Exactly.
Thank you. Just for Rebecca as well. I work in a public library in Melbourne, and we do have quite a large local history collection. So would you have any advice for how to go about going into that and finding those sorts of stories?
Yeah, so is it a similar period to...
It would be, yeah. I mean, Australia colonial periods are like 200 years, so not that long. But it would be around sort of 1800s leading up to more recent. It's mostly council records and things like that. So great books, microfiche, newspapers, things like that. And photographs and people's stuff, but less so. Mostly council records.
For me, because it's quite daunting, like just having that huge amount of records. But for me, it was trying to narrow it down in terms of language or where I thought that might appear.
Like the punishment book.
Exactly, yeah. So unfortunately, it's like, you know, and you have to think about in the obviously mind of when they were as well. So for me, it was kind of looking through kind of names and then cross-referencing once I found a name, because as much as then I could go to newspapers and records, they were like, if you don't have a name and a date. So particularly for me, it was finding out in the UK what language would have come up in how they were talking about people at the time, or how they were describing LGBTQ+. In other workhouses that have different, so in ours I saw it as indecency, but in other ones it's come up as kind of unnatural and things like that. So again, it's seeing what as well was in the institute that you are looking in, but it was a lot of manpower and searching through as well, and seeing about how they were recorded. But I think language is the key for that one.
And feel free to the others. I mean, there are so much expertise in this room, so please chip in if you have anything to add. But please.
I'm just thinking about the two presentations side by side, and just alongside my own research, which is investigating currently a colonial court case in Singapore where a British officer was charged under Section 377A with a Malay boy prostitute in Singapore, and my inability to actually find any records of from the perspective of the male prostitute. Not because they have been actively suppressed, mm-hmm. because they're just absent. And every single document that I capture is from a colonial perspective, from the judge perspective, and mm-hmm. that coincides with what you're talking about in the frustration in dealing with archival materials. And I'm just extrapolating upon that and thinking about your decision to record this particular incident from the perspective of nurses, mm. which eventually is still a position of power. And in this case, their responsibility and their task is mm. to enforce. Mm. And yeah, as a jailer, as mm. you have mentioned. Mm. So I'm just thinking, because I'm not very sure of what's the situation like now in mm. Australia, but how would be an alternative way of using the methodology that you've highlighted, mm. which is oral histories, to speak to these people mm. Or the indigenous communities who have been, I mm. guess, incarcerated under mm. this public health. Is that something you're looking to?
Look, it's a really good question, but I guess I think, in this particular case with the incarceration stuff, with the recalcitrant management, I agree that nurses are in a position of power. But I think that that's not something we can say generally about nurses during the AIDS crisis and the role they played. But definitely in this specific case, that's right. Unfortunately, this was 87 and these people had AIDS, so they died. Not that everyone died from that area, but these people at this point of management, they had what was called then full-blown AIDS. They didn't make it to 96 for the therapy. So retroviral therapy. So I guess it's a really good question. Something I've been thinking about a lot because I've been thinking as well about how I'm going to come back to Alan, because he's going to see my thesis before I publish it. How I'm going to come back to him and say, this is what I'm saying about what you did, because he's very proud of what he did. He thinks he defended the Australian populace from the ravages of HIV. Like, that's his position. And for me, the decision is that, well, like, I have a responsibility to Alan because he's a living source, that, and he's someone I have a relationship with now. But I have an equal responsibility to the people who died under his care. And even though, in oral history there's a tradition of kind of, giving primary responsibility to the living source, I think in this case, because of the nature of the HIV epidemic at the time, that responsibility is equal for me. And that nurses' stories have a very particular quality in that way, because it's a way to get at story. Like, obviously they can't tell the stories of people in their entirety because they're not that person, but they can give us an insight into people's dying days and last days and how they lived and how they died in a way that we couldn't really get from anyone else, perhaps from their partners. But it is a very, very unique viewpoint. So I guess that's kind of how I'm thinking about it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, I also have a question for you, Geraldine. I was very mind blown by this. You said that it's still... Did you say that it's still ongoing, that this still happens? Okay, so then I wonder about that, and then I also wonder, have you published your research? I mean, have you had any response from the Australian gay community about this yet? I mean, can you... Mm-hmm. Is it hard to talk about this in Australia?
I think... Okay, I'll answer the first question. So, yes, it's still ongoing, and it's not incarceration anymore. It's very much just kind of like checking up on people, making sure they're taking their medication and stuff, but it's still discrimination. Like, there is no other virus that is treated with this public health response in Australia, even though really now hepatitis C is a much more dangerous virus to have, but no one gets put under management for having hepatitis C. So it's homophobic and it's discrimination. So for that reason, I'm excited to publish it. I think that's an important contemporary point. I haven't published this this particular research. It's, I'm writing my PhD, and I will publish it. And I wondered if there might be some people in the room, actually, who who were there at the time, but I don't think there are. Oh, Russell, actually. Yes. I actually think that there's a debate to be had in the gay community about the fact that this was never responded to. Like, I don't see... I have endless respect for Phil Carswell, but I think he should have published that report somehow. Because actually, you know, this was an out-and-out case of racist discrimination, and it was attached to HIV, and the AIDS Council should have responded. I don't think that they did. I haven't found any evidence that they did, and I think it was because basically they didn't want to jeopardise the relationship with the government, and I think there's a discussion that we need to have about that relationship and what it meant.
Maybe I can add a few things about that, seeing you pointing in my direction. I should point out I'm not a historian, and I, a few years ago, was involved in doing a huge amount of research, co-preparing an exhibition about the first 10 years of the AIDS epidemic in Melbourne. Just a couple of things. The whole thing about the model of cooperation, the Australian model, is definitely the case. Like, it was clearly the best happening in the world. As soon as you get into the archives, you can see the battles going on, and the forces, not so much the government is kind of there, but things like the scientific community, there was... there were figures in the scientific community who saw themselves as figures of power, and they knew best. And that being contended against with community representatives like Phil Carswell. Phil Carswell's entire archive was destroyed in a flood in Brisbane. He kept all his documents. What you might not be aware is Pennington's archive. Have you been through that?
No.
So David Pennington was the chief scientist, who was also an antagonist, tried to be sympathetic to the community that had difficulties and wanted to have control, partly because he felt guilty. He'd been in charge, he was a haematologist, he'd been in charge of the Red Cross blood bank, and a lot of people died after he'd said it was safe. And so he spent the rest of his career trying to compensate for that. His archive is massive. He kept everything, and it's now at the Melbourne University Archives. There's about 8,000 pages of documents purely about HIV. If Phil wrote that report and he brought it to the council, it would be in the Pennington Archive. having said that, as someone who's gone through that entire archive, I don't recall coming across it. And while there have been discussions here and there, there was a recommendation at one point from the Secretary General of Medicare, the public health thing, recommending incarceration for all HIV people. That memo still exists, but it was completely overridden. I don't recall any other references to the kinds of things you're talking about. So that is... Today, that's been the first I've heard about that.
Thank you so much. Another question?
Yeah. Thank you for this amazing panel. I'm still processing so much of what you said. I have a question to all of you, and I think it's also adding up to what you asked. So you said, like, being out LGBT is maybe also a privilege, and we only know, like, these flamboyant histories of big cities, maybe. But like you all show in different with different approaches, like the marginalized groups and people, even like among the communities. And I wanted to ask, like, how is it possible to not tell not tell it as a, wow, okay, that's the flamboyant queer stories and that's the violent part, or like to not only show, like to also to show the violence, but in a, I don't know, also show, a, show not victimize them so much and make them like, yeah, show them as subjects also, and like, yeah, at all the intersectionalities that you opened up.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's what we always try to do, that it's not that, that if there's a voice of somebody's own voice, it's always the best, cause, but for not that many people have like records of their own voices, but then we try to like reconstruct or use other methods that it's not only like a, it's not like depressing, but also that gives hope to other people that, that they're like empowering stories.
Can you share an example maybe of the museum?
Well, yeah, it's there's so many stories we like, especially now after like 100 years of after our civil war, and there were so many stories of like tragic stories of people, but then and at the group of like red lost party, and the like one story is that the themes that they, their goals, I could tell that they were, even they lost the war, they've got their, like, almost everything that they hoped for is now have come true in a way that it's sort of, like, it's not, it wasn't for nothing that they died. Some kind of stories like that, that they had, like, a strong will and they were willing to sacrifice so many things, and then not because they won, but because they lost, in a way. There were so many things happening in the Finnish society that that the lost party was taking part to the governmental decision-making, and then the whole Finnish society became like a discussional society that also had to take care of the poor and the children like who lost their parents, and so the social security started to grow from there. So it's not an LGBT story, but in a way it's also like a bigger story of Finland.
To get in one last question.
Yes, short question. I have a question for Lena. You talked about the 1,300 objects, LGBTIQ objects, since 2003, and I was wondering if that's that are all new objects, or are you also redefining objects who are still in the collections and giving new catchwords to them so that they can be found as LGBTIQ objects?
Well, they are new objects, but because of our collections are mostly like the institutional level, they're like flags of trade unions, and so it's not very easy to to read them in a queer way. So there are not that many like personal objects in our other collections. So that kind of like reading is not really, yeah, we've thought about it a lot, but there's not that many objects that you could do that because of the context they were, or at least for them they don't have enough context. We don't anymore know like what was this and why did it come to the museum in the first place. So many stories have lost.
But when there are some objects, are you trying to clear them?
Yes, of course. I mean, we have a old photograph of two men holding each other, and of course, we don't know anything about them, but we put it to the LGBT collection, because who can say that we're not saying that they were a gay couple, but we're just saying that they have a relationship. So.
Thank you so much, and I'm sure the presenters will be happy to continue the discussions and with all those interested. But I think we should thank them for their excellent project and presentation.